Hello, and welcome to the Ace Pod, episode 1.11, brought to you by the law offices of E. Jason Blankenship. We're back for another mailbag this week. Instead of doing the usual email-Twitter split, I have divided it by topic because that's just kind of how it worked out this week. And we're going to dive right in with, as usual, an existential question. This is from at NDDub on Twitter. Level of dread heading into this PSU game. How does it compare to your most dreaded Michigan football games? Honestly, I'm not dreading it a ton. It's after that Iowa game, that Iowa Penn State game was reassuring for, you know, probably the wrong reasons for Penn State, but you know, to see them play an ugly game against Iowa just at least means that Michigan should be capable of bringing this game into the muck. And hopefully they can overcome the Nittany night game problems that they've had. But I remember 2006. Shoot. But yeah, I mean, in terms of how it compares to dread from previous years, nowhere particularly close, to be honest. I mean, there is some, you know, there is a desire to see this offense work out and not feel like we're in a constant loop of things going poorly and more poorly than expected on that side of the football. But in case we've forgotten how bad things can get, I would like to invite you back to the year 2014. Because that season, by October 15th, Michigan had lost four games. One of them was to Rutgers. One of them was a shutout loss to Notre Dame to break a record streak of not getting shut out. One was at home to Utah in a game that almost nobody saw the end of live, including me, and Minnesota, which went so poorly in terms of handling an apparent Shane Morris concussion that there was a protest on the new school president's front lawn the next week. And Michigan's lone victories to that point in the season were over Appalachian State in the rematch nobody wanted, Miami of Ohio, and an 18-13 win over a Penn State team that would go 2-6 in the Big Ten. So at that same time, I was in the middle of tracking down an email that had been posted by Wolverine Devotee on the message board and somehow picked up as a report by Keith Olbermann, who at that point was hosting a nightly show on ESPN2. And there was a very snarky Dave Brandon email, and that actually kicked off the whole investigation that would get published on October 28th, 2014. So we're really a couple weeks away from athletic director getting under the fire to the point of a forced resignation. But Brady Hoke was still the head coach. There was actually not certainty that he would be fired despite how poorly this was going. And Michigan would be heading into an absolute, this would be a merciful bye week in 2014 before heading into a game at Michigan State that went as you would expect from that year. Some level of dread heading into this Penn State game. I would like to see the offense show a pulse against a real team and, you know, show some innovation. So something that we were promised in the offseason. But things have been far worse. I went to school during the Rodriguez era. So, yeah, I've seen some things. Feel like this isn't that bad. Next question. Without the numbers, it seemed like they completely went away from the orbit motion in the second half. This is the Illinois game, obviously. One, is this actually true? And two, did it negatively impact the run game? It sure seemed like it. That is from Pat Mostalski on Twitter. Is this true? I mean, it did seem like they started to shut down the orbit motion stuff. I haven't done a full rewatch of the game other than going through it in 5-second increments for the GIFs post, because I really should be getting to basketball stuff right now. That's Brian's job and Seth's job, and we got to spread things out. So I haven't gone down play by play to see if they totally shelved the orbit motion, but I don't. That wasn't the reason. I don't think that the run game stopped working as well in the second half of the Illinois game. The problem was that they realized that they had no need to respect the quarterback keep. And once they realized that, they could devote an extra player to the run game, an extra player to the handoff, and that makes things more difficult when there's another player to pick up. So yeah, we've been pounding that one into the ground all season, but it remains the case. In a related question, this one in an email from Justin. On a scale of 1 to 10, what is your confidence that the QB run game will be a factor in the offense? I feel like Shea has run the ball just enough when his back is against the wall that he's given me enough false hope that we'll see it more in Happy Valley. I wish I shared that false hope that we'll see it more in Happy Valley. I mean, it was nice to see him pull it out on a critical third or fourth down, I don't remember at the moment, play against Illinois. And pick up the first down, obviously, because we have trained opponents to not respect the QB keep. But do I expect it to get worked in? It's hard to figure out because it's hard to parse what is Gattis and what is Gattis avoiding even putting reads in there, because Shea Patterson appears to be quite bad at making the correct ones. But I don't know. I can't, you know, we've been hoping for weeks that they'll turn it up. Michigan's already lost a game, so it's already cost them. So I don't know. On a scale of 1 to 10, I'll give it a solid 3. How about that? And that's more based on I don't have faith in them using it effectively, as opposed to I assume they realize at this point that they, you know, should have it in there. But Patterson's just been so bad at running it that and Dylan McCaffrey had such a poorly timed injury in terms of maybe seeing if you can get a quarterback competition going this season. I'm worried about how much they'll even want to turn to it. And then it's a matter of can they come up with other ways to create some space for their skill players. They should be able to do that. Not every team in the country has a mobile quarterback that they use. Next question from the run game comes from at Jaguar Pascal. Was it a mistake to not promote Ed Warner to offensive coordinator? At the very least, the run game / O-line would be cohesive and organized. I don't think this was a mistake, because Ohio State tried this, and it did not go great. It is probably why Ed Warner is at Michigan right now. In 2014, they had the number 2 SP plus offense in the country under Tom Herman. In 2015, Herman had left to become the head coach at Texas. And Ed Warner became co-offensive coordinator with Tim Beck. In 2015, Tim Beck was more, I believe, the guy leaned on for play calling. They dropped to 14th in SP Plus, despite an absolutely loaded offense that year in terms of talent, even more so than usual. The next year, they tried emphasizing Warner a bit more on offense, and they dropped all the way down in 2016 to 32nd in SP Plus offense. They were number 2 in rushing, so that does feel like some good Ed Warner stuff. But they had the number 69, not nice, passing offense in the country. And that after that, they let Warner go, and he went over to Minnesota. They brought in Ryan Day. And in 2017, Ohio State jumped back to the number 3 offense in the country. So, and even going past the numbers, there were systemic issues with Ohio State's offense, with Warner kind of running the show, and Ohio State fans had a lot of complaints about that. So, I don't think that was the play. I preferred bringing in a young coordinator who would kind of take the offense in a dramatically new direction, and a modernized direction. We've just yet to see whether Michigan made the right decision in that case. I don't think it was a big mistake to not promote Warner. They've got him in the right spot. As Ohio State found, he is best utilized as an offensive line coach, and maybe having him help out strategizing the run game, but you don't want him as your play caller. You don't want him coordinating the whole offense. This one is from underscore Keel Tyka on Twitter. Another run game one. What do you know? Going forward, should we start Haskins over Charbonnet since he has been less fumble prone? In short, no. I don't believe Charbonnet has had more than one or maybe two fumbles this whole season. So we don't want, you know, obviously Michigan has a massive team-wide fumble problem so far this season, but that has been spread out across so many players that in terms of an individual guy, if this were a normal year, there wouldn't really be someone that you were looking at other than maybe Christian Turner and going, this guy looks like fumbles might be a problem. There's nothing I've seen in Charbonnet in terms of the way he carries the ball that makes me think that it should be, it's going to be an issue. And while I was impressed by Haskins last week, it was Illinois. They have major, major problems with their run defense. They give up huge lanes to a lot of teams. And while I don't think I'm as skeptical about his ability to play as I think Brian may be, that you can certainly unearth some guys low down on the depth chart at running back and realize that you probably should have been playing them all along. Charbonnet has already flashed the five-star talent that we were promised from his recruiting profile, and I certainly want to see more of that. So, you know, he had a kind of unfortunate one, as we discussed on the MGO podcast. Charbonnet did get kind of ear-holed on his fumble against Illinois, so that doesn't seem like a thing that is particularly replicable or particularly his fault. Just kind of one of those fluke things. So, no, I wouldn't start Haskins over him. I would like to see Haskins get worked in because it does seem like Christian Turner might have a fumble problem. So I think that's the direction we're going to see. And Haskins also gives you more. If he's decent at blitz pickups, he gives you more upside all around than True Wilson. And he definitely gives you more upside as a runner. Switching over to special teams. This one is from Doug. Okay, here's a question. What's going on in the kicking game? For all his promise in high school, Nordine has turned out to be unreliable. Competitions in practice are apparently not conclusive. This is a weakness that doesn't get addressed, so admittedly, it ain't nothing compared to the questions on offense. Amen to that. The thing with kicking is, unless you're really focused on bringing in a dedicated kicking specialist, and there are like two of those in the country, and they run Cole and Kornbluh, and they run their own camps. And I think they do much better doing that than they would being the special teams coach at a college program, where they probably would be that. But you have a special teams coach that's, it's mostly focused on strategic stuff, X's and O's type stuff. For the most part, even in the NFL, kickers tend to just kind of work on their own for the most part during practice. I mean, obviously they're getting watched and filmed and graded, but in terms of being able to predict how a kicker's practice success is going to translate to the field, whether there are technical issues that need to be worked out in their form, that's stuff that more gets worked out at camps in the off season, or, you know, the kickers kind of coaching themselves. So, I don't know, like, Nordine had an amazing leg. Number one kicker in the country coming out of high school, also attempted all of two field goals, I believe, in his senior year of high school. There's just not much to go on with this. It's even more of a crapshoot than most, the recruiting at most positions for college. And I think that plays into why hashtag college kickers is definitely a thing, and also why you see some, you know, the Groza finalists aren't necessarily, you know, get all guys from Alabama and USC and Ohio State. You know, it tends to be pretty random. So it's just one of those things where, at least for place kicking, Michigan's, you know, thought they had the answer in Quinn Nordine through recruiting with a scholarship. Thought they had successfully replaced him last year with Jake Moody as a preferred walk-on, and now this year both of them are missing field goals. So I don't know. You just hope you hit on your lottery tickets in the kicking game. This one is a more specific rules question. This was an email from Steven. I'm trying to figure out if I don't understand a rule or if the official screwed up and no one noticed. At the beginning of the second half, on a play right after the one where we got flagged for the late hit on the QB, Illinois was called for a hold. Michigan accepted the penalty, and the next play it was first and 17. Why was it not first and 20? The hold happened behind the line of scrimmage. The runner got 3 yards, so it seems like they marked off the penalty from where the runner went down, which makes no sense. A similar off-topic question is why sometimes penalties are marked off, but it remains first and 10. In the Seahawks game, the Seahawks got a first down and then got called for an after-the-play unsportsmanlike conduct penalty. The ball was moved back 15 yards, but it was still first and 10, not first and 25. I feel like if they hadn't gotten a first down on the play, it would have been, say, second and 5, and they wouldn't move it back 15 yards and keep it second and 5. It would be second and 20. I've seen this happen multiple times where a line of scrimmage gets moved back, but it remains first and 10, so it seems like it's a rule, but an odd one. Thanks, Steven. To answer the second question first, yeah, it isn't a quirk of football where if you get the first down and then there's an after-the-play penalty, it does not affect your yardage to gain, which obviously they can't do if you pick up an after-the-play penalty and you haven't yet achieved the first down. Football has some rules that don't really make sense logically if you dig too deep into them. It's a weird quirk of the rules. As for the first instance, the first question about the placement of the ball in the Illinois game, yes, the refs did screw up. That is 3 free yards for Illinois. If there is a hold behind the line of scrimmage, it does not matter how many yards you gain on the run afterwards. That should be marked off from the line of scrimmage. So that should very much have been first and 20. Did not notice that live, but weird. Ref stuff happens. One last one before going to take a quick break here. This one is from Daniel. Because we just played Illinois, I'm curious what recruit were you most excited for who didn't end up panning out? Shout out Brandon Peters for you. My answer may be Daryl Stoneham. So yes, I must admit that Brandon Peters was a bit of a miss for me. I was very, very convinced he was the future quarterback. Obviously, that didn't end up being the case, and he ended up stuck behind Dylan McCaffrey. And what we saw of him on the field at Michigan and before he got hurt at Illinois didn't show what I thought he was going to be. And yeah, it's tough to evaluate quarterbacks. To throw in another couple ones out there, the OG for me is Sam McGuffey. The McGuffey mixtape. I know I was not alone in getting extremely hyped to have that guy on campus and in Rich Rodriguez's offense. It seemed like a perfect fit. I believe Brian put vast for his recruiting excitement in Sam McGuffey's recruiting profile. And it turned out he was just too small, not quite built for Power 5 football necessarily at the running back position. And it's harder to leap over linebackers at that level. And then to flip over to the other side of the ball, Andre Pipkins, both for his ability at DT to seemingly cover sideline to sideline in the Army game, that looked very promising. Michigan's real need for DTs at the time. And the fact that he just seemed like a really fun guy to have on the team. He showed a lot of personality as a recruit, so it was disappointing that things did not work out for him here. And on that uplifting note, going to take a quick break and come back with more of your questions.
When your plumbing breaks, you hire someone who knows how to fix plumbing. When your power goes out, you hire an electrician. When you are injured in an accident, you should hire someone with experience. Jason Blankenship, a Michigan law graduate, has over 20 years of litigation experience to help you. Jason has handled matters and venues across the state and country, from various circuit courts across the state through the Michigan Supreme Court and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Jason's experience in both federal and state courts makes him able to handle your complicated personal injury case. Before starting his own firm in 2014, Jason worked at a large plaintiff's firm, but he left in order to give his clients the personal attention you and your case deserve. Jason selects each case personally, and you will deal directly with Jason to resolve your case. The insurance companies have teams of lawyers on their side. You should have someone on your side, too. Call 248-533-0516. That's 248-533-0516, or email jason@blankenshiplawyer.com. All right, we are back with more existential stuff. I mean, what'd you expect? A few kind of big fandom stuff questions to start out this section. First one is from Jay. Is there such a thing as the H-pone, the happy place of no expectations? What if the B-pone is actually a black hole through which one emerges and then you're just happy to be there? Happy to have attention. Hi, game day. And think maybe something good could happen. Probably not, but what if? Let's tailgate. I imagine this is how Indiana or Northwestern fans feel every week. I think I'm their repent state. Am I a bad fan now? As always, thanks for the free content analysis, Jay. You're certainly not a bad fan. It sounds like you're becoming a very reasonable one. And I certainly think if you look at the history of Michigan football, where Michigan fans think the program should be versus where it has been since, the end of World War II. Michigan fans always talk about winningest, and it's like, okay, well, we did a lot of that early. So I think there's a good place to be where you can take joy out of a season where Michigan loses to Ohio State. It's possible. It's not easy. It's possible. It is very much possible to get to a point where you can enjoy these games with very little expectations attached to them. That's something that, you know, I certainly went searching for ways to enjoy the team back when Rodriguez and Hoke were coaching, and either I was an undergrad or covering the team. And absolutely one way to do that is to kind of wipe the slate clean of expectations, realize that they're often, you know, well, sometimes they're based in reality, including our expectations for this year's offense. I think we're based in reality. There is a point where, especially with college football, you just never know, and it's easier just to kind of roll with it. So, you're not a bad fan. And there is a part of me that looks at, not necessarily Indiana and Northwestern, but some other kind of mid to high tier, let's say Iowa, as a fan base that, you know, knows they're not going to be in the national title conversation or even the playoff conversation or even potentially the conference title conversation every year. But they really love it when they are, and they can also find things to appreciate about an 8-4 season. And that's a solid spot to be. That does not mean your program is a complete wreck. There's something to be said for treating Michigan. Michigan is a historically better program than Iowa, and I would expect Michigan to be better most years, but is there a recalibration that it might be healthy to go under if you're a fan? Yeah, depending on how you're handling it. In that vein, if you could switch places as a fan with any team in the Big Ten West, would you do it? I have a friend who is a Wisconsin fan, and it seems like it's a more enjoyable experience because they know who they are and aren't constantly being disappointed with sky-high expectations. Mike. I always feel weird about this because this is still very much like a personal thing. Like, I'm a Michigan fan. I know how to handle being a Michigan fan. I know it hasn't been great from a football perspective. of late, but I do expect that to turn around at some point.
And Wisconsin may very well, you know, Barry Alvarez is only going to be around for so long. And Wisconsin, historically, not a great program. Really not. Went through some really brutally bad times where they just were not good at all. Like bottom of the Big Ten bad. So, I mean, I've seen what bottom out looks like for Michigan, and that's a couple years of losing records. I think three to be exact over the course of 8 years. And that was a historical anomaly. So I'd rather stay on board with the one I'm familiar with and the one I grew up loving and just find a way to adjust my experiences to reality for the most part. That said, if I had to switch places, I would choose Iowa. I think they just do it right. I really do. Wisconsin would be close, but I just love the way Iowa goes about it. And that, Camp Randall's really cool, but that Kinnick Stadium experience is really something. I was really impressed. That was probably the coolest game atmosphere I've been at on the road. In what turned out to be a game that I would rather not talk about. So let's move on. This one's from a different Mike. I've always been hesitant on getting my kids into Michigan sports because, well, you know why. But recently my 9-year-old daughter has started asking to watch a game together and even randomly wearing an old Henny jersey around the house. Any thoughts on how to proceed? I mean, Mike, I don't know what to tell you, but it sure sounds like your daughter is going to be a Michigan fan whether you like it or not, so I would embrace the bonding experience. I wouldn't worry. Kids don't hold on to this stuff like adults. I mean, they might cry in the moment, but man, like, kids do not have a football game hanging over them through the whole week. That's just not how kids operate. So if you're worried about causing, like, permanent psychological damage to your child because they embraced Michigan football, no. I mean, if they willingly decide to get into it as an adult, stay into it as an adult, that's their choice. But if your daughter's 9 and she's asking to watch a game with you and she's wearing a Henny jersey around the house, it sure sounds like she wants to spend some time with you. So I would take that opportunity, take advantage of one of the beautiful things that college football and sports in general provides, and use it as a chance to get closer to the people that you are close to. All right, we are changing course now. This one is from Jan Kostin on Twitter. How excited should I actually really truly be for men's basketball this year? I'm excited personally. I mean, I think that excitement in large part is born out of a fascination with how this is going to look, because I just have very little idea. Not only is there a significant amount of roster turnover and, you know, the questions on that end of things, but there's also a wide open Big Ten this year. You know, the intrigue about how Juwan Howard is going to coach, how he's going to be received, I assume very positively, how he recruits, which I think should be quite exciting. And I mean, I also just love basketball, so I'm ready for basketball season pretty much no matter what. In terms of a high level of success, if we're talking about excitement at that point, you know, Michigan plays a difficult schedule. And they're probably going to go through some growing pains, transition costs, whatever. So, we will see. I mean, I'm excited to see how those go, because I'm a basketball junkie and I'm just curious to, you know, to unpack how much of Michigan basketball's success the last year or two has been on John Beilein and Luke Yaklich versus, you know, having... and how much, you know, versus having Xavier Simpson and John Teske on the team, and also how much of that can carry over. And I expect a fair amount of it will on the defensive end. And then, you know, what is this team's identity going to be? How good is Franz Wagner? I think he's going to be excellent. I'm really excited to see him out there and hearing some good things on that front, kind of leaking out from the Bill Davidson Center. Yeah, I'm hyped personally, and that's not just because football's been disappointing. This is just how I generally am for basketball most years, and you know, in a year where behind Michigan State, there's really not a lot about the Big Ten that's known. And, you know, I think Michigan can make a real run, even though I think probably more reasonable expectations are to get in the tournament closer to that bubble. But it should be really interesting. It really should. Genuinely excited for basketball this year. On that note, got a couple questions along these lines. From at NaptownJazz12, do you see the stacked non-conference schedule as an advantage or disadvantage? It very much, I hate to waffle, but it very much depends on how Michigan kind of levels out and whether they can avoid dropping an ugly one here or there. Because if things go on the kind of lower end of expectations this year, they could be on the bubble for the tournament. And then if you're just trying to ride quality losses, that could get you into trouble. Michigan's got to accrue wins somewhere. There's a pretty big gulf between their quality non-conference games and their other non-conference games. So stacking up quality wins, it might be difficult, especially if the middle of the Big Ten is a little soft. So it could be a disadvantage. Like, I see it more likely being a disadvantage come tournament time. At the same time, if they gel, if they pull off an upset, and they do have a, you know, senior point guard, senior center, that should provide a good base. And maybe that does give them a little bit of an edge early in the year against other teams that also have experienced a fair amount of turnover, regardless of the talent. And then maybe you see Michigan pull off a big upset or two early in the season, and that turns this difficult schedule into a big positive because you get several chances at a signature win. So we'll see where it goes. I don't have a super strong opinion one way or the other, because I think these things mostly sort themselves out. And personally, I'm excited to see Michigan play in a bunch of big games. I do not particularly enjoy when the non-conference schedule features, you know, one or two marquee games and then a bunch of stuff that is BTN plus worthy. All right, last one I'm going to do in this section is, who will have a longer honeymoon period, Juwan or Jim, and why? That is from at Karstens13 on Twitter. And this one to me, I think, is pretty easy. Juwan Howard, because he coaches basketball and not football. Even though expectations for the basketball program have been raised significantly over recent years, if Michigan backslid a little bit, I don't think there would be this enormous outcry. Meanwhile, Jim Harbaugh has the football team in a better, much better position than the last two coaches had it in, and also in a better position than the coach prior to those two guys had it, you know, left it. And we are still at a point where the natives are restless. We'll go with that, and have been for a couple of years. I would be shocked if Juwan Howard, if people were, unless things just totally went to hell, and I did not see that happening. I do not foresee people calling for Juwan Howard's job within 4 to 5 years, and that being taken at all seriously by most of the fan base. So, although I could be proven wrong, there were people calling for John Beilein in like 2017. So, who knows? But I do expect, mostly because of the nature of the sports that they're coaching, that Juwan Howard gets a longer leash from the fan base. Also because you get more cracks at beating Michigan's your chief rival, and beating Michigan State. And Harbaugh has the unfortunate setup of getting one shot a year at the best team in the conference to placate the fan base. So that's a tough one. I expect it to be a little bit easier to navigate for Juwan Howard. And quite frankly, we can only hope so. I'm going to take one more break and then come back with something I'm very excited for on the other end. It's an off-topic section with a big Songs of the Decade question.
When your plumbing breaks, you hire someone who knows how to fix plumbing. When your power goes out, you hire an electrician. When you are injured in an accident, you should hire someone with experience. Jason Blankenship, a Michigan law graduate, has over 20 years of litigation experience to help you. Jason has handled matters and venues across the state and country, from various circuit courts across the state through the Michigan Supreme Court and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Jason's experience in both federal and state courts makes him able to handle your complicated personal injury case. Before starting his own firm in 2014, Jason worked at a large plaintiff's firm, but he left in order to give his clients the personal attention you and your case deserve. Jason selects each case personally, and you will deal directly with Jason to resolve your case. The insurance companies have teams of lawyers on their side. You should have someone on your side, too. Call 248-533-0516. That's 248-533-0516. Or email Jason at blankenshiplawyer.com. Okay, we are heading into a question that I spent way too much time putting together yesterday, and I'm going to try to include some audio in this section while working it live. Pardon me if there are any moments of audio awkwardness here, but I'll just get into it. Colin TJ asked me, what are your top 10 songs of the decade? And when someone asks me a question like that, I start scrolling through my iTunes library and looking at stuff. And what I ended up with, to make a long story short, was a top 50 songs of the decade. And then I pulled out an ordered top 10. What I will do is throw a playlist on Apple Music with these, because I had at least one person who requested that. I am not on Spotify because I am locked into an Apple Music family plan that was a gift, and I'm holding on to that for dear life. But if somebody wants to endeavor to make a Spotify playlist from the Apple playlist, by all means, have at it. So I should have that posted by the time this goes up. If I forget, feel free to yell at me on Twitter. And with that said, let's dive right into it. Number 10, a little background for me is Charmed Life by Icebird. This came out in 2011 off the album The Abandoned Lullaby. Icebird was a project by the producer RJD2 and singer Aaron Livingston. They had originally worked together on a track for RJD2's album, The Colossus. And prior to that, Livingston was best known for doing the hook on the song Guns Are Drawn by The Roots off The Tipping Point. This is an album that, I'm one of those, you know, play when my friends come back in town from, for holidays or whatever, they, want to pull whatever I've been listening to lately. And this is the number one album that I've played for, whether it's driving somewhere and I throw this on in the car, or a friend asks where they go, what is this? And please give this to me. I don't know how this didn't get wider release, but it's really good. So this is a little sample of Charmed Life by Icebird.
I like to be comfortable. Give me the key to that 5-3-0. That's right.
took a left.
Sorry for the awkward fade ins and outs. I'm doing these manually. But yeah, I love that song. Livingston's just got this unique, weird voice that works really well over RJD2's production. So, that's one of the albums that I've spread around probably the most over the last decade. Does help that it came out in 2011, so it hit on the early side. Next song for me, Nico Case is a favorite. I was listening to The New Pornographers, which was kind of an accidental indie supergroup in Canada that she worked on with AC Newman, and they were major indie rock luminaries to the point where her Wikipedia page says she's considered an honorary Canadian, even though I think she's actually from Washington. But her solo stuff is awesome. I really like pretty much everything she does. This is Night Still Comes off The Worst Things Get, The Harder I Fight, The More I Love You. She does not go short with the album titles.
Drugs to keep me slow, a hilarious joke for some dead pharaoh, but now not even the masons know what drug will keep that from coming. That are made from my hands, but the tide smashes all my best laid plans to sand. And there's always someone to say it's easy for me, but I've revenged myself all over myself. There's nothing you can say to me. You never held it.
Right, just had to get a little bit of that that hook in there because I really love that part. Nico Case, just like get all her stuff. She was also one third of the really excellent Case Lang Veers collaboration album with Katie Lang and Laura Veers that came out in 2016. That is very much worth hunting down. I really like all three of those artists. I've been listening to Laura Veers especially quite a bit recently. Just really good indie rock. Number eight is a band that is just ludicrously consistent to me. And that is Spoon. My choice for favorite song they put out this decade, I went with Hot Thoughts off of the album by the same name. This came out in 2017. It is their most recent album. And they were going for like a sexier vibe than normal with this one, and they hit it. Love that little woo that gets thrown in there. You can really feel the for a band that is pretty tight, is pretty straightforward. It's nice to hear that kind of like energy. I thought that was a really good album, pretty much front to back, and that was a standout track off of there. Next song for me, The War on Drugs. Lost in a Dream was on more, you know, album of the year list than I can care to count. There was a very good reason for that. It's got, I loved like the dreamy guitar based, it is just really lovely music. It is music. It usually kind of pulls towards sad. It is kind of, you know, maybe a little updated Springsteen, if he was, you know, a bit existentially depressed. But I picked An Ocean in Between the Waves. I could have picked several songs off of Lost in the Dream. It's a great album, but this is a personal favorite.
Just don't be the same anymore. That might as well be gone.
If you heard something in the background, that was definitely the chair moving while I was playing air guitar. Yeah, it's one of those bands that'll do that to you. That just they have really catchy, brilliant guitar hooks that they just run through these lovely songs. And they have put out an album since Lost in the Dream, but I think Lost in the Dream is their strongest effort. Number six for me is Future People by the Alabama Shakes. This came out in 2015. This is very much Brittany Howard's band. She's got a new solo project that's called Jamie that I haven't given it enough of a listen yet to figure out if I wanted to throw any of the songs onto this. But it sounds excellent on first listen, and I'm going to need to revisit it. A little background on Brittany Howard, just pulled straight from Wikipedia. She is the lead singer of the Alabama Shakes. Howard was born in Athens, Alabama, to a white mother and an African-American father. The family house was in a junkyard and once burned down due to a lightning strike. She learned to write poetry and play the piano from her older sister, Jamie, who died from retinoblastoma in 1998. Howard got the same affliction but survived with partial blindness in one eye. Her father left the family soon after. So you get that rather heartbreaking background, and then you hear her sing, and you understand why she sings the way she does. You can both hear like the ghosts of the dead coming from her soul and out her vocal cords, and also, man, also these songs just rip. I had to let that roll until that guitar and bass thump just came in. By the way, I don't think I mentioned the name of that song. That is Future People by Alabama Shakes off of Sound and Color, which came out in 2015. And there's another one that is a really delightful album front to back. and one that I highly recommend. And very similar message goes for this next group. Number five from B is All Right by the Rural Alberta Advantage. This came out in 2017. This is off The Wild, their most recent album. But they also put out Departing and Mended with Gold in this decade. And they have another that missed the cutoff by a year and would have made choosing one song by them even harder. As the name indicates, these are some Canadians from the wilderness. And yeah, you can get that feel when you listen to their music. So this is All Right by the Rural Alberta Advantage.
You realize, I said there's nothing left. Not long ago, I whispered in the night. You whispered back and cold. Started racing out of touch. Not long ago, last night, sitting in the dark, I was being difficult. There's a weight in my heart that was atypical. Tonight we're racing out of touch. Are we getting wide headlong into the night? I was all alone, I was contemplating letting you know. But tonight we're speaking code.
That's just, I love that song. I mean, that goes for most of these, but I could really let so many of these just keep riding. But I imagine that would be a bit of a copyright issue. Fair use only extends so far before you're just pirate radio. That weight in my heart, that was atypical line. That is atypical. They have lyrics that'll hit you right in the gut. They're great, like, cold or rainy day music, shocker, you know, they're the Rural Alberta Advantage. These are some cold Canadians who do really great breakup music in large part, but also just all around really good. Love their stuff. Number four is Another Life by D'Angelo. This is your friendly reminder that for people that love Neo Soul, Voodoo, D'Angelo's kind of album Triumph, came out in 2000, and then he went on a 14-year hiatus and absolutely did not miss a beat when coming out with Black Messiah in 2014 under D'Angelo and the Vanguard. That was the band name there. You get the... and this is... Another Life is the last track on the album. You kind of get the full, wonderful D'Angelo gamut on this song. You get Questlove on the production. You get him killing it on the falsetto. When you dig into the lyrics, because it is generally quite hard to understand D'Angelo and what he is saying until you can see it on paper. I realize it's a really lovely, sensual song, too. D'Angelo is great whether you're kind of listening to him singing as an instrument first or, you know, as a lyricist. And the song is just so, so, so good. Not liking the fade on iTunes, which seems to go from quiet to zero with nothing in between, but sorry. Yep, that was Another Life by D'Angelo and the Vanguard. He's just wonderful instrumentalist, wonderful singer. Gets such great production when he's working with Questlove and I would assume several other members of the Roots and putting this stuff together. And it was just so awesome. I mean, even if we never get anything else from D'Angelo, we now have Brown Sugar, Voodoo, and Black Messiah. And for any artist to put out three albums of that quality in their lifetime is remarkably impressive. So we have been blessed by D'Angelo, and it was very nice to see him come out of hiatus. Number three is a band I've been listening to almost nonstop for the past couple years, along with the band that lands at number one on this list. Rolling Blackouts Coastal Fever is an Australian band led by three singer guitarists who take turns writing songs, and whoever wrote it just gets to sing it. That's pretty cool. That was something they mentioned on a live show on KEXP that I was watching on YouTube. And this song has like an awesome, just sudden drop where you just get right into it. I love the way it starts. I love the way they layer their guitars. They are super catchy. This song also contains the line, "I am standing here like a burning house," which is a line I feel in my soul. So this is Julie's Place by Rolling Blackouts Coastal Fever off the French Press EP, which came out in 2016. So good. Still can't get that fade right, though. Yeah, Rolling Blackouts Coastal Fever. They also came out with a full length called Hope Downs in either 2017 or 2018 that I thought was excellent. They have two EPs that were great that led to the full length. But yeah, like good, chill, just good natured. Aussie music, Aussie indie rock. I like it. Number two on this list is a bit of a departure, and that is The Art of Peer Pressure by Kendrick Lamar, 2012, off of Good Kid, Mad City. Would very much be in the running for my album of the decade. Picking just one Kendrick thing was quite difficult. I don't think I mentioned, but when I went into this, I limited it to one song per artist, and that includes artists making guest appearances. Cutting down one thing for Kendrick was really, really difficult because he's put out, you know, several different projects this decade with dramatically different sounds, and I think they're all really good. To have this be kind of his major label introduction to the world, and to pull off a song in The Art of Peer Pressure that features to me like some of the best storytelling rap since Andre 3000 on Aquemini, that it's just insane. And he's only proven since then that he is the best rapper on earth, and also one of the most creative. And it was, you know, you worry when you get this, a spectacular, critically acclaimed and widely loved debut, like you did with Good Kid, Mad City, that it might be sort of a situation like Nas with Illmatic, where maybe the artist keeps trying to capture that again and never quite does. And instead, Kendrick has really, he hasn't tried to just make Good Kid, Mad City 2. He keeps doing different sounding projects. And I think that's really important to stay interesting. And it also makes it easier to pick something off of his original album, because he hasn't just been working on updating that sound. He's gone in different directions, and they're all quite good. And I need to stop talking and just hit play.
Everybody sit your down and listen to true motherfucker story told by Kendrick Lamar Rosecrans. Smoking all the finest dope, ay, 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 ay. Drank until I can't no more, ay, 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 ay. Really, I'm a so-and-so, but I'm with the homies right now. No favors, rushing it quick to laugh about it later. Aye, 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 aye. Really, I'm a peacemaker, but I'm with the homies right now.
And mama used to say, say,
one day it's gonna burn you out.
If I wanted to actually display like all the things that are amazing about this song, I'd end up playing the whole thing, so that's why I just played the beginning and the hook. Yeah, hearing him just, you know, talk you through a robbery is amazing. And the way he so easily tells a captivating story while rhyming, and not simple rhyme schemes either, is just unbelievable to me. So that for me hits number two. Number one should not surprise people who listened to episode 1.9 of this podcast, where I did the better part of a segment on this song. It is Bodies by Car Seat Headrest. And since I have already discussed it at length, I'm just going to play it. Since I didn't really get into the content of the song last time, it's like this really wonderful song about, I overuse these words too much, but I'll work on it. It's a great song about kind of how, you know, reaching the point in your life where you realize, like, I'm still young and I'm with these great people that I have, you know, come to love at this kind of, you know, formational point in my life. But also you are at the point in your life where you are starting to think about mortality. And there's this line that he repeats in the song where he says, Will Toledo, the lead singer, goes, "Don't you realize that our bodies," where he says, "Don't you realize our bodies could fall apart at any time?" Relatable personally for me. So it's a song that hits for me personally. I also think it's just a phenomenal song. And the way that the instruments are layered, just Car Seat Headrest is great. I will once again recommend that you listen to them. So that is Bodies off of Twin Fantasy. And that is the 2018 version of Twin Fantasy, Face to Face. As discussed in the previous episode, there that was originally an album that was kind of an unfinished 2011 project. Whew. All right. So that was the top 10. I will have, like I said, I will put up that, that playlist on Apple Music. I'll be sure to tweet that out because there were a lot of extremely, extremely difficult cuts, in here. And even narrowing it down to 50 was difficult and took, a healthy portion of yesterday afternoon. So I hope that wasn't a complete waste of time, and some of you will dig into some music you hadn't heard before, or re-examine some music, and or do whatever you want with it. But I'd love to hear some feedback on that, because I did spend some time on it. Moving on to something completely different. This question is from, on Twitter, the North Campus Turkey. Shout out to the North Campus Turkey. Who hit the first home run you ever saw in person at a Major League Baseball game? My answer of Dave Berkman pales in comparison to the mechanical engineering professor I asked who was able to truthfully answer Lou Gehrig. Yeah, my answer isn't that good either. I was able to look this up. You know, I couldn't totally place the game because this was in 1995. It was in Tiger Stadium. I went with my dad and my best friend at the time and his dad. Gloves in hand, seats way, way, way down the third baseline. Up way, way up. But it was the reason I could find this is because I knew the Tigers were playing the Texas Rangers at home. I remember that Cecil Fielder homered at some point in the game. And I also remembered that it was obscenely hot. So I managed using the powers of baseballreference.com, which is an incredible site, to track down the specific game in question. It was on June 19th, 1995. The Tigers lost 6-4, which sounds about right. This was kind of like the very sad petering out of an era year for the Tigers. This was Sparky Anderson's last season, Lou Whitaker's last season, and Kirk Gibson's last season. And Kirk Gibson they had brought back after a couple years with other teams as he was well into his 30s, late 30s by that point. Alan Trammell would hold on for one more season after this. But to answer the question, the first home run I ever saw in person was evidently hit by Chad Curtis off of Kevin Gross in the third inning. Cecil Fielder would homer, and so would Bobby Higginson later in the game. And the Tigers lost 6-4 because they only got seven other men on base. Pat Ahern got the loss, if you are curious, because baseball people are like that. This is where I should also mention that I was at Justin Verlander's first no-hitter in person. That was a good time. If you, unfortunately, there's no way to predict this, but if you do manage to witness a no-hitter in person, cherish that shit. It is unbelievable. It is different from any other sporting experience I've ever had. That's for sure, because you know you're taking this one out of 162 game that you weren't necessarily super invested on the way in, and all of a sudden you are hanging on every pitch like it is life and death, and it's all really down to one guy. I mean, you do have the fielders playing a role to be sure, and there were a couple big defensive plays in that game, but man, it was a privilege to watch Justin Verlander, especially in person at that game. All right, two more questions, and I will be done yapping. This one is from at Blue and Joe. What are your go-to pizza toppings? I'm not big on the just like let's throw on the meats on the pizza. I'll do that every once in a while, but like that kind of overloads it for me. I usually like a relatively simple two-topping, one meat, one other thing pizza. So I like something like pepperoni and mushroom is a go-to for me, and Italian sausage and black olive. If I want to go veggie, doing the mushrooms and black olives combination is a winner for me. And I am also one of those horrible people who does enjoy ham and pineapple on a pizza. So I don't really have like a go-to order, but one of those. I'm easy with pizza. I tend to roll with whatever other people want to get around me, but if I get my choice, those are my go-tos. Finally, this is from at the W. Gibbons on Twitter. Gimmicky top three things you love about the state of Michigan. I went earnest with this one. Number three is Ann Arbor itself. Growing up there, I love being in a walkable college town, and just all the cool things that you can do there, and having access to like world-class services from a world-class university, and the way that it is interwoven with, you know, campus and the city are, you know, kind of intermeshed. But there's also kind of, you know, student-y parts of Ann Arbor that you discover when you're in college there, and then towny parts of Ann Arbor that you hit up when you're not a student, that students don't ever bother to check out. So I have to give a shout out for Ann Arbor personally, plus Ann Arbor itself, plus like just how fortunate we are to have access to U of M and all that provides. It's pretty cool that we got that here. Number two for me is Up North, just as a concept. I just threw my arms out wide in my chair while saying that. I think you have to do that. Whether it's getting up to like Traverse City or getting all the way up into the Upper Peninsula, it's just beautiful up there. And I love it both. I mean, in the summer, it's great for, you know, want to go on dunes, you want to go on hikes. I love being on the lake. But at the same time, I think there's something really awesome about being up there in the winter where you can kind of pack yourself in a little bit in a cabin and do that type of thing. My parents have a place just on the other side of the Upper Peninsula in Canada, and I love it up there. And that's sort of an extension of up north for me that requires a passport. But that is another wonderful thing about Michigan, is easy access to Canada, although that did not make the list. Number one for me is, and if you've ever seen photos of me or me wandering around on the town, this probably does not surprise you. It's sweatshirt and beanie weather. When it's like 60, 65 degrees and not so sunny that you're sweating through whatever your bottom layer is, that's the weather for me. And Michigan gets to hit that in both the spring and fall, although sometimes it rushes through it, which I do not appreciate. But we are just getting into it right now, and I could not be happier. I am wearing a sweatshirt and a beanie at the moment, even though I've got headphones on over the beanie. But that's how I roll, and that is the number one thing I love about the state of Michigan. And that is all for the podcast this week. Thank you to everybody who sent in questions. If you would be so kind, rate, review the podcast on iTunes or Spotify or Google Play or Overcast. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Show a little love if you're enjoying what you're hearing on the MGO podcast channel. And finally, thank you to the sponsor, an important thank you. So thank you, E. Jason Blankenship, and your law office. That is it for this week. I will be back next week.